and call. But we do have a microphone at the testifiers table, and we do have recording equipment here, so when people do come forward to testify, please try to speak towards the microphone so that we can capture this, because it is a public meeting. This public meeting was brought about by legislation brought forward by Senator Troy and Representative Roger Erickson during the propane crisis, asking the Legislative Energy Commission to look at some alternatives we might have in our state where we could reduce the dependence on propane in a couple of ways. Senator Troy was particularly interested in us looking at piping some natural gas in from North Dakota, and we were interested in also looking at some other alternatives, and we've looked at some of those this morning. I'd like to start with recognizing our Executive Director, Annie Levinson-Falk, to give us an update.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your packets, you do have just a one-page update. I'm going to try to have updated version of this available at each meeting so that you're aware of what's been happening over the last month since we last met. First of all, this, as Representative Horvin said, this meeting is just one piece of a longer inquiry that we've been asked to do by the legislature into propane supply and various alternatives. So work is ongoing. We're having an intern that's going to help us with research this fall from McAllister College, which would be wonderful. And we are going to be convening a kind of informal working group, which some of you have already signed up to participate in. If anybody is interested, just let me know and I'll get you on the list for that. We'll just be holding an occasional conference call to give input to a report that will be prepared for the legislature by January 15th. And as a commission, we'll be coming back to this topic at our December meetings as well. Just a couple other updates before we get started here. The last meeting on June 30th, we had an overview of the EPA's proposed clean power plan rule. That's currently in its comment period. EPA is taking comments through October, and then it's going to come out with a final rule next July. So the Pollution Control Agency is leading that effort on behalf of the state of Minnesota, and we're keeping informed through working with them. Bob McLean earlier mentioned last week's Clean Energy Economy Summit as part of the National Governors Association Clean Energy and Economic Development Project that the state of Minnesota has won. That's an ongoing effort between now, or I should say last September and this coming September. And in addition to the summit, it's included ongoing work with various clean energy sectors and pretty deep analysis of the clean energy industry and economic impacts in Minnesota. So that is another thing that we're participating in and expect a report on that later this fall. And finally, the Energy Future Framework, as you know, the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources recommended funding for this framework. This also comes out of 2013 legislation asking the LEC to develop a framework for Minnesota to get on as much renewable or clean energy as quickly as possible. So that's been recommended, and next step is the 2015 legislature for action. Department of Commerce has also submitted a separate proposal to the U.S. DOE for collaborative partnership and support, and which we'll also be hearing about this winter. Anyone also who wants more detailed, more regular updates on that should contact me, and I can put you on the list for that as well.
That's it. Thank you. Our first testifier today is Roger Leiter from Minnesota Propane Association. Thanks for traveling to be with us today to give us an update.
Not a problem. Standing, sitting, do you care?
Totally up to you.
Good. I'm going to stand. Thank you. I'm Roger Leiter, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Propane Association, and I work here on behalf of the 180 propane marketers and the 80 some odd other suppliers to the industry that supply services, equipment, and products. And so I was asked to kind of give a little brief about, a very short brief about, well, number one, what happened last winter, and two, where does our propane come from, what does our outlook look like for the coming year, what's being done to circumvent what we went through last year, and try to put all those pieces together, and most of it's ongoing, but we'll take a look at it. Just kind of a quick look of what happened last year, and this, some of this detail was taken from a report given by ICF International, a group that studies the shortage and what happened and why, and things that happened in Minnesota last year, no secrets, crop drying. It was big, it was wet, huge crop, and it was very, very consuming of propane. Cold weather. I'm not sure it's over yet. I mean, we've only had like a couple 90-degree days. This is not normal. This is we could use a little more warmth. Cargo exports. We'll talk about it. The United States, in the last 3 years, has moved into the export market with a vengeance because of all the production. Capacity outages and constraints. Those capacity outages cause shortage, spot shortages, particularly here in the upper Midwest and for people of Minnesota. Canadian demand and inventory has a big impact on what happened. And the Cochin Pipeline reversal projects that were going on. And that's something that's gone away. And I'll try to hit on all those pieces here and there throughout the presentation. Where does our propane come from? Propane in the United States is produced and processing either crude oil or natural gas liquids. In the past, when I began in the industry, it's like darn near half century ago, most of our propane came from processing crude oil, or over 50% did. And now that's shifted, and most of our propane now is coming from getting it out of the ground through natural gas liquids, processing those natural gas liquids, and getting our propane. 85% comes from natural gas liquids from natural gas wells. We'll take a look at that. The 30% processing of crude oil, and another 10% from imports. Obviously, that adds up to more than 100%. We have a lot of propane in this country, and because of that, we are now exporting. So we have a lot more here than we can use, and I know one of the big things last year was, let's cut all exports of propane, and we'll all have enough. We could have cut all exports in January, and it still would have been in Texas, and we wouldn't have propane here. So it's more than that. It's a distribution network and things that we need to do. The U.S. is now a net exporter of propane. The U.S. production is expected to increase 60%. We're going to produce 60% more propane in the next 7 years. And we're going to have more product to export, but hopefully more product to use within the country. And we just have to work out the logistics that we have here for Minnesota to get that through. All of that's coming about because of the shale play, the things that are happening around the country. Really, you start to look at it, and the Bakken is big in our mind because it's very close in North Dakota. There's a lot of oil production out there. There's also a lot of natural gas liquids being produced out there. A couple weeks ago, I took my wife on a romantic trip for a couple days. We went to North Dakota. It doesn't get any better than that. Spent a couple days out there looking at oil wells, what they're doing, all the activity that's happening out there. And it's huge, and it's big. And there's a lot of, and it's, when I was out there, they said they hit finally the million gallons, or the million barrels, or million gallons a day. They hit the million mark. And now they're going to 1.7 is where they believe they will end up. Production of oil, 1.7 million barrels a day. So it's, what's that?
It's a lot.
What's that?
A month.
A month with it? Okay. All right, I saw it. It seemed like an awful lot. So there's a lot of production there, but that production is also happening in the East Coast, in the Pennsylvania area. It's also happening in Texas. They're finding more and more oil in underground in Wyoming, Colorado, and other places such as that. All of this, because of their discoveries, has changed the natural distribution network. There used to be a lot of influx of propane from Canada and products into Minnesota, bringing a lot more product up from the south to the Midwest, bringing product up from the south going to the East Coast. Now those areas are producing products, and all these pipelines now are trying to figure out which way we go, because now we got product that should flow a different way to make match up with exports, match up with the needs around the other parts of the country. So that's causing a lot of change in what's happening, and that's what we're going through right now, is that change as we talk about. We'll talk about the Cochin line. But there's a tremendous amount of oil play. There's one place that's really absent and on top of the map that doesn't have anything going on.
Yeah.
Minnesota. Everybody else has got something that can happen, but we don't have that. Propane will continue to grow aggressively. You start to see on that map where it's all coming from. The traditional forms of where we've gotten propane from before, the natural gas wells that were in existence, the production from crude oil is going to continue to decrease over the next few years. And all those multicolored spots are different types of or parts of the country that have shale plays, where they are drilling into the shale, extracting the gases, and getting the propane out. That's going to continue to grow exponentially over the next few years. And that's a good thing. It's good for the economy. It's good for the people of the country. Big part of what happened in Minnesota last year, or one of the pieces of the five or six C's that I put up, was the Cochin Pipeline. Cochin Pipeline was put in about 1978, or in operation at that point from Fort Saskatchewan all the way through North Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, and back into Canada, Sarnia. They used it to move product, ethanes and other things, through the line through. Propane was part of that mix when it first started. They would have, in the early days, they would have probably four to 10 days of propane run in the system, and then they'd switch over and run ethane through the line, and then they'd run propane, ethane, back and forth. Integrity on the line became compromised, and so that it couldn't handle all the pressures of ethane at one point, and it had some other issues, so probably about, 15 to 20 years ago, it became a propane-only line. All propane only was ran through that line. The problem that they had is that even everybody on that line through all the states, most of us use the main amount of propane that we use is in the wintertime. And we use it very heavily during the wintertime, but not during the summer. And so that when they look at an annualized basis of what that line was doing, it was only doing about 30% of its capacity. So you have an asset, a big asset that's out there that's only performing at about 30% performance. Because of that, and now because of all the shale plays we showed up in Canada and other places, they found they need to take that line, or they had an opportunity to reverse the lines and take condensate I guess it's called condensates, it's pentanes and other products from the Chicago area market, gather them all together, and ship them north on the line. That now line is now moving north from the Chicago area back up to Fort Saskatchewan, taking dilutants, and they use that product then to dilute the heavy tar sands so it'll flow through the oil pipelines. And that's really what happened to that line. And they've got a 10-year contract at 100% of capacity. The business decision was not hard for them to make of what they needed to do. But it does leave us with a little bit of a hole. A decade of decline coming into this past year. Going back to about 2003, that's propane use in Minnesota. We were steady at a decline. Building was going down. Construction was going down. People were getting more efficient. And we had probably 5 of the 8 warmer winters we've seen in a long period of time through that time period, and propane use just continued to decline. If you're declining on use of propane, what happens to the people that are storing propane, whether it's in Conway, Kansas for us, or in Canada or other places, as they look and say, are they going to use that in the Midwest this next year or not? And they start to look at what they can do with it. If they have excess propane, they probably weren't going to save it for us because they started to look at our trending numbers. Now, this last year, we turned it right back around and had one of our highest uses of propane in the state of Minnesota. I think it's a little higher than that chart even shows by the time I get done figuring all the numbers. But, so it's a high use of product and, this last year. But with those trends, people were not prepared for what happened last fall and last winter. We did not have supply in place where we needed it to be. Propane exports. We're looking at the last 3 years, 2011, 12, and 13, and you can see the growth in exports, and that mirrors the growth in production that we're seeing across the country. We're having more and more propane production, and we ship it all over the place. Mexico has always been a strong user of propane from the United States, being right across the border. We've imported from Canada, and we've exported to Mexico. That's been pretty common over the years. And now we're still going to import some from Canada because it's close, it's convenient, but we're not going to be able to get it by the pipe like we used to. Now it's going to have to be done by rail. But these exports, these other countries, are up picking what they will use in propane, especially since it's so close. It's close. The Latin American countries, shipping costs is not so much. They will continue to increase their use of propane. Europe is a big user of propane. That was probably a savior last year. It wasn't as big last year as it normally has been. Europe had a warm winter. Because they were warm, there were ships of propane that were headed for Europe that were diverted to the northeast coast of the United States. And that really helped stave off some problems that we had in our country. But you start to look at this, and we have to understand that if things that happen here in Minnesota are affected internationally. There's things that are going on internationally. Demand. Countries in Africa and Asia and India, places like that, are out in the rural areas are finding how to use more and more propane. It's clean, it's safer for them to cook, it's better for their health, and so they're trying to expand that. Expansion in Minnesota, I'm going to go through these quick because I have them down on the sheet, but there's expansion in Minnesota of infrastructure to deal with the problems that we had this last year. Solar gas in Mentor, Minnesota has an underground storage cavern there that they fill with propane, and we draw on it during the wintertime. That underground cavern will not be enlarged, but they're going to increase their loading capacity, both rail unloading into the caverns and loading out for trucks over the next year, phase one. Phase two, they're going next summer, they're planning to put in at least a, I can't remember what it said, they had 500,000 gallons, 500,000 gallons above ground storage. That'll be dry storage that they could use much more during the wintertime as a buffer. They're hoping to increase their total capacity at Mentor by the end of 2015 by 60%. That's important for Northwest Minnesota. Very important for what's going to happen there. Infrastructure, CHS has really stepped up to the table and done a lot, and is doing a lot. They're building a site in Hanford, North Dakota. It's important to know that at the bottom of all these where they're building a rail facility, that the rail line that they're using. This one they happen to be using the BNSF line. They're putting in storage and the capability of loading rail cars in North Dakota. Again, it's important in North Dakota to have that. Otherwise, some of those people in east of North Dakota are going to come to Minnesota and use some of the product from here. It puts more stress on ours. Fairmont, North Dakota. They've created a deal with the cooperative there that already has a rail facility to expand it and to upgrade it. Glenwood, Minnesota. They've really beefed up that facility from a 450,000 gallon capacity to 1.3 million of storage and the ability to unload 8 rail cars within 4.5 hours. Upticking. They're making all this a little bit better. Rockville, Minnesota. They've done the same thing in cooperation with Winter Propane, that they're increasing the capacity there. They're moving on. Different BNSF there. The last one was CP. And they're looking at doing something in Wisconsin. And again, it's important to see what they're doing in Wisconsin. Otherwise, everybody from Wisconsin likes to come to Pine Bend Refinery, pick up the product that we have here, and take it back. Totally understandable, because we can go to Iowa and take their product when we can. End result is that we have to find a way to, in Minnesota, has to find a way to get about 36% of its product that used to come in on the Cochin Pipeline. It used to be about 135 million gallons a year that we brought in through that pipeline. And now we've got to find a way to displace that through rail, other facilities. Rail's going to play a big part in that. We're going to need more rail cars, more rail transportation, more rail space. As everybody knows, rail space is getting tighter and tighter every single day. Transports. New transports are being put on the road. Companies are looking to have trucks out, having to go farther and to wait in line longer to get product. But that's one of the things that they're doing, at least in the short term. Transports, you get more of them up and running. When I first made this slide, it was in January, and I had September 14th was a delivery date for a transport. That is now about next April of 2015, if you order one today. It takes that long, so it's getting out there. Increasing the weight of a truck in Minnesota should have a transportation post off, and we can do that. But increased truck size capacity would help.
Over here. Over here. House,
all right. All right.
Senator Dibble, that's great.
I'm just going to talk to Representative Earhart. Talk to Representative Earhart.
Okay.
It's a discussion we need to make. But we look at the rail lines in Minnesota, and they are going to be our friend this winter. Whatever we can get out of those is going to be extremely important. All the different rail lines that we have some choke points, and we have some problems. Getting product, sometimes it can get to Minneapolis, but it can't get back out to where it needs to go because it's so congested. They don't have enough engines down here to move them to do what we need to do. It's becoming extremely challenging. Not only for us. You talk to the grain haulers, you talk to the people that are doing other things, it's the same way. Nobody's noticed any trains full of oil going up down the track. A lot of it. Some terminals that we have in Minnesota, now places we have products. One of the questions that Annie asked me to think about was, what's our capacity? How much could we load out? We have the capacity to load. I mean, the rail capacity that's being built, we could do all the propane that we need to do in Minnesota if we could get the cars from Canada to here or from North Dakota to here. It's not a matter of having the capacity at the terminals. It's a matter of getting it from there to here. But think what we've got, you know, the things that are in place, we have the opportunities. Need to make note, though, you know, we worry about the coaching going away, but we have to remember that we have a major pipeline that comes up from Iowa and goes through those bottom three dots in a row, the two blues and the red area. There's a pipeline that comes in that supplies about 55% of the propane to 60% of the propane in Minnesota has for years. They did a fantastic job, the D-Enterprise pipeline, last winter of bringing product at a maximum rate. That same pipeline serves Iowa, parts of Illinois, parts of Nebraska, and parts of Missouri. So it's really pushed. And last year it just so happened that all these states had cold winters, high demand, and a large crop grind, so it was a challenge. They did an excellent job. We really did see how much they could do. And so I think that we have an opportunity there as we look at the answer is that pipeline is probably going to help us more than we think. We're also going to have rail that's going to step up and do more than we believe it could. We're also going to have trucking assets out there. I look at it and I think that our future is going to be good. We have to replace that. Yes. It's going to require increased performance by other pipelines. I believe that's going to happen. We'll require increased additional infrastructure for rail deliveries being done. We're going to require increased storage capacity at marketer and consumer levels. Marketers, we've got two, three in the room here today. They've all been increasing their storage capacity. One of the co-op people that's on my board talked about it the other day, and they have taken 20 farms that were taking small 1,000-gallon tanks. That's not necessarily small, but on those farms, 20 different farms have put in 18 and 30,000-gallon tanks in place of those small tanks. Just filling those tanks is a quarter million gallons. That's one cooperative that's doing that. So they're starting to put infrastructure in place. The farm community is embracing this and will help deal with what we're doing at that level. It's going to change delivery strategies. What I mean by that is that we've been in Minnesota, because of the pipelines, because of the way it's went, we can almost turn on the tap and get the propane when we wanted it. And because we have two pipelines and a great infrastructure, price didn't fluctuate horribly between summer and winter. It would always go up, but not to a great degree. So people didn't have a tremendous incentive when it's 90 degrees outside to fill their propane tank in the middle of the summer. We are finding that we have to change that mindset. We have to get people to fill propane tanks during the summertime. And it's happening. I see the gallons that are being sold into the state of Minnesota every month. In June, gallons were up about 25%. I expect July and August to be the same, and going into September, I think we're going to see a summer increase. What I think is going to be probably about 40 million gallons of product sold this summer that wasn't sold last summer. Tanks being filled. That's an important part of what we do. Propane demand in Minnesota, what do we plan for? We average about 400 million gallons a year of retail sales of propane. Last year, about 475 million. 2 years ago, 327 million. It's hard to make that swing. That's a big, big swing in product change and demand. Planned demand can always be accommodated for. If we know what's going to happen, we can plan for that. But when you have something that happens way out of the blue, it's tough to make it. Interruptible natural gas and electric off-peak systems are unplanned demand, and they put a huge stress on the system. We had places that were taking 80 to 100 semi-loads of propane for an ethanol plant, for instance, or something like that, in the peak demand that we had in January and February. Very tough, you know, to plan for that demand when it's only every 4 years, every 5 years or more. So achieving 2-to-1 ratios is what we seek for. We're trying to move on. What that means is that a propane marketer, as they're buying from a Canadian supplier, that Canadian supplier says, I will give you 2 gallons of product in the wintertime for every 1 you buy in the summer. Problem is, in Minnesota, we use 3-to-1. So we have to find a way to get more product sold into the state in the summertime. Different ways of doing that. And there's one of the things is trying to build our market. It sounds weird, but one of our answers to our problem is to sell more gas. Engine fuel, on-road, fleets, other people that are going to use propane on-road will help us in the wintertime throughout the year. Marketer on-site storage we talked about, customer storage being increased, delivery strategies. Somebody asked, how much do we have? You know, if marketer storage is full, I suppose there's 20 million gallons. I think that's wrong. I think it's closer to about 45 million in the state. If all customer tanks were full in Minnesota, 100 million gallons. 100 million gallons of customer storage. A lot of gas. But getting them all full at the same time, or people being able to have the financial wherewithal to do that, are a challenge. Terminal storage, probably another 10 million besides Mentor. You know, so we have to kind of think about where our gas is coming from. Billing year-round load, like I said, is auto gas. Off-road, summer filling of all propane customers, those are things that we need to do. We need to move forward. Drove up here in a propane-powered vehicle. I'm sure a couple, at least one or two of the other guys have too. And it's a way to go. So where do we go? What can we do? We need to streamline any regulatory process for increasing storage. We'd love to see incentives for companies and consumers for installation of storage infrastructure. We'd like to see some type of incentives for auto gas. Same attributes as clean burning natural gas, only we have a lot better distance that we can travel on a tank full. Full mechanism to fill high heat propane users during the summer time. And I think Representative Borman, we talked about that during the sessions. We have to work with our counterparts at the federal level to see if we can't make that work. Got to be able to find a way that we can fill our LIHEAP folks during the summer where they can save money, we can stretch the dollars, and make better use of those funds to make that happen. Change in mindset. People need to plan their energy source. We can't just turn on the tap and it's going to be there. We have to think about it. Pre-buys, budget payment plans, cap pricing are all mechanisms that people can use. Summer fill, finding some way to do that, make that happen. And it has worked. We've been running ads on, we ran the Twin Cities market early on. We run statewide for the Mid-Park during the Minnesota News Network. Now we're running KFAN because there's some interest in Minnesota Vikings, and that's statewide with KFAN, all those markets. We're hitting those areas and talking that message. There's something that consumers can do. They can fill their tank. They can pre-buy, they can get on a budget payment plan, get on scheduled delivery. If they do that and work into it, and it seems to be working because our marketers are getting calls. So that seems seemingly to help. So those are things that we're looking forward to do. And I know you got a lot of people from that.
Thank you.
Can I clarify the remark that I made about the month?
Yeah.
It was a million barrels a day for a whole month. They averaged.
Oh,
you're right.
I'm not often wrong, but I can't.
Questions from members for Mr. Leiter? We don't have our usual chirpy members here to ask questions.
Yeah, you taught a Sonia win. It's a lot faster and quieter.
I'm sure Representative Garofalo will have a lot of questions for you. We'll email him the PowerPoint and catch up with you.
That'd be good. I actually presented with him at the chamber a couple weeks ago, and he did. He had answers for me. I wasn't sure I was looking for him. But Senator Sundin?
And Madam Chair, and I think you've probably just alluded to the answer, but it would seem to me that if I was propane sensitive, I would, and if I had the wherewithal, I would make sure that tank is full this summer, anticipating winter. Do we right now, you know, if we had a good, what do you call it, a request, et cetera, et cetera, if there was demand for gas right now, Are the tanks ready to be filled by at least the retail market?
Yes, it is. They're sitting very good on storage and supply right now. One of the points that I did bring up is one of the things that happened last winter was that supply got so low in Kansas, they had to actually slow down the amount that they could pull out of the caverns because they were hitting towards the lower levels. And it's not to get into it too much, but if they pull too fast, they're going to pull salt water with it, and they have dehydrators they need to use. Those caverns are restoring product. We're already almost now at the level we were in September of last year. Storage is about two and a half to 3 million barrels ahead of last year in storage. So our supply that we're putting underground in different places and in the marketers are doing is way ahead of where we were a year ago. And so not only is the infrastructure in Minnesota getting better, but we're seeing the supply, whether it's in Canada or Conway, Kansas, or Bushton, those places are filling up a lot better. Yeah, and we definitely could handle any demand that would happen right now by some of them.
Senator Dibble.
Well, these days I'm really interested in the freight rail industry from a couple of different perspectives, all keen on the level of congestion that there is on the tracks right now. Part of that is the oil train and safety issue. Part of that is just the number of oil trains coming through. I think we just got the news in the paper. We have 50 oil trains coming through Minnesota a week. Not a big surprise, given what we suspected was the case. And then, of course, just freight itself is burgeoning for whatever reason. So we have suppliers, manufacturers of all kinds having trouble getting their product to market on the tracks. We have these issues with the oil, and we have issues with passengers, you know, whether it's commuter rail or Amtrak, not being able to get through on a timely basis. What are you seeing in terms of how quickly they're investing in their infrastructure? We talked about the sidings and additional tracks and throwing cars at the problem. How quickly is that problem resolving itself in terms of the capital investments the freight companies are making themselves?
Mr. Leiden.
Senator Dibble, Commission, that's a tough question on their side. What we're seeing is that they're looking at prioritizing. They're looking at if they're going to do a new siding or a new switch to bring propane into an area, they're looking at where it's going to do the most good, where they're going to have the most opportunity to bring product. We have a large one. One of the things that we lost this last year was replacing the Benson Terminal. A million-gallon terminal on pipeline was great. Well, it's now going to be served by rail. They seem to make a priority to get that switch and terminal and rail tracks brought into it. So I think they're behind, but I think they're bringing things up to speed as far as groundwork. I think one of the biggest problems I keep hearing is not enough engines. Not enough engines to move small trains, small loads from the hubs out to areas that are more rural. Some of the locals are having some issues with that. And one of the fellows told a story the other day about the grain train coming into his cooperative, and he said they had 3 engines on the grain train, 2 pulling it, and one of them being worked on. The mechanics were on the train, fixing the engine on the train while it's driving up and down the track, so they don't have enough time to pull it off, and they needed it as soon as they filled up the grain to pull the train in. So
So they're doing repairs on the train. That's the kind of the desperation level that they're seeing, but it's exponentially going up. We're concerned. You know, we have a marketer in northern Minnesota, Baudette, who's had rail facility for years and basically being told now that the CN Railroad is not going to deliver to them. Basically, we're not going to stop here. We keep going through here with oil and everything else, and we're not going to stop for five rail cars of propane fuel. And with that, those things are happening. I think they're concentrating on larger facilities. That's really what's happening.
I'm going to just add just one side comment. I see Hoon in here and other folks interested in agricultural issues. And I don't know if it's been mentioned to you, but we're putting together a hearing probably when?
It's
going to
be late September.
Late September to do. We just had a study come out of the University of Minnesota that showed that our economy is losing $100 million per year attributable to this problem just out of the ag sector. So this is touching on a lot of different arenas in Minnesota.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions for Mr. Leiter? Thank you very much for being willing to serve as a resource for us. We will keep the conversation going, especially if the weather changes in a couple months. Now we're going to turn and talk a little bit about the agriculture sector. Nice segue, Senator Dibble. Doug Peterson is here from the Minnesota Farmers Union to give us an update from the farm. Welcome to the Legislative Energy Commission.
Thank you, Chair Hortman and Marty, and Senator Marty, and all the other distinguished senators. I think this thing was started how many years ago?
94.
I was one of the first members of the commission. And that was because of wind and Perry Island things. You might remember that. Well, I have a little bit of legislative history. I've been served 12 years in that and then went on to Farmers Union. I'm Doug Peterson. I'm president of Minnesota Farmers Union. And, you know, the issue that you have, I'm going to just talk extraneously about a lot of the things that I heard already, a lot of the things on the PowerPoint. Where'd he go? There he is. Very correct. The issue on rail and how that affects agricultural as we get diesel fuel, fertilizer, how we ship out grain, all of that seems to be coming to kind of a head with Bakken Oil and rail service and the amount of cars. And we have commissioned a study through the National Farmers Union through Whiteside, an individual out of Montana, who says that the rail speed is being slowed down. So you're not getting the same amount of speed that you had last year out of the rail cars. That's a huge effect for all of this competition because you're going to have propane, you're going to have fertilizer, you're going to have feed, commodities going out, commodities going in, and we're going to have a crop that has to be dried. I might say also that we might have missed a perfect storm again. 36 to 40% is supplied from the Cochin. That has now been reversed. We're not going to be seeing that. The earlier task force that the government maintenance set up said that the infrastructure, though CHS is doing quite a bit, will fully not be developed to meet the demand until 2018. So we may be in the same ballpark again as far as the perfect storm of not having enough propane. Only Mother Nature will know that if it's decent winter. That means 10 below on the average, not 30 below. But there is another condition that the crop season in the south has been planted and it's mature, and we're not going to have the demand from the south as we will had last year because they were late last year in their crop and drying seasons. And in Minnesota, got in fairly normal. The corn, which is basically dry corn, we're going to have a shorter crop this year, and it is going to be wet because of the immaturity of the corn at different levels when it matures and the moisture content. A comment about farmers putting on more storage, that is happening. If you go to any place that has a propane tank, for storage, that is going pretty high on sales and that. So that's that's pretty expensive stuff. It's a lot of demand out there because it got short last year. I know the neighbors in my area, Western Minnesota, Madison, where I live, they were getting a supply once a week for drying their corn. So if you have a 1,000-gallon tank, you use that up. You could use up 1,000 gallons in one day. Then you have to run the fans and the stirrators to make sure that that grain doesn't heat up on you, and then you get your next batch. We sometimes couldn't put the fans on to freeze it down. Freezing it down just means you're going to freeze the moisture in the bin, and when it, you have to still at some point heat it up. So you're still going to be using that. We have a lot of concerns about this. This is going to be one of the top legislative issues for us, not only at the state level at Minnesota Farmers Union, but also the national, just because of the fact we're heavy users of propane, not only as home heating, but also as the crop drying is a concern. I did talk about some of the issues that come forth. Replacing that 40% that we're going to be losing is going to be a real, really, really hard to do in the amount of time that we have. Hopefully Mother Nature will look at us favorably. Concern that I raised last year on this, my wife and myself, we have propane, a 1,000-gallon propane tank for our house. We paid, I think, $1.67 for it in the fall, and then we went through, and then the price spiked. I think we were up to $3.73. I talked with my local co-op manager, Western Minnesota Dawson. He gave me stories that confirmed the pulling of the salt out of the caverns down there. Some of the more dramatic stories on pricing was the fact that we had people paying $5.50 a gallon. And I even had reports of some people paying $7 a gallon for propane that was in the tank or in the line for about a buck and a half. Price gouging investigation, Department of Commerce, Attorney General, should be looked into. Send that wet message out that if this comes back again, price gouging should be looked at very seriously, because we have plenty of people on income assistance, and that income assistance ends up being the government paying for that, and also people that just can't afford at that point level. Now, pre-buy, fill up your tanks. We've already done it. A lot of other people are going to do it. Hopefully that'll ward off some of that storage. But the other thing on the elderly on fuel assistance, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're on a dollar, not a gallon amount. So when you use up your dollar amount, you don't get any more gallons. Something to think about. And I know that's federal and all of that stuff, but that has to be looked at. If we have a severe winter, that's going to come up again. Also, as a national farm organization, I'm National Farmers Union Secretary, and one of the legislative pieces that we've always had, much like a strategic oil reserve, a strategic natural gas reserve, a propane reserve, should be looked up by the government. President Obama came through, and I believe he did free up some money for assistance on gallons for emergency, but that has to be looked at the federal level, and our senators and representatives and the commission could probably make those recommendations too. The issue of informing consumers about the shortages and what to do, very, very important, and I think the state agencies are on the right track. I think you may have to redouble your efforts on that, because not everybody really thinks they should fill the propane tank when it's 90 or 100 degrees out. Until you find out that you can contract it for $1.60, and in the middle of the winter you're going to pay $3 or $4. That's real money. You should be looking at that, telling, basically it's a bottom line pocketbook issue. That I think is being worked on and moving forward. You can do more with that. I don't know if there's any easy solutions to this thing, other than it turns into a really, really nice winter, and the crop comes off the field at 13.5% all number two corn, never number one, Senator. I think you know what I'm talking about there. The issue on rail and the use of rail cars and engines and repair and where they are and where they're at on sidings and all that, I've been in front of the Surface Transportation Board twice this summer, once in Sioux Falls and once in Bloomington. And I should step back just a little bit. If you have any control over how they act or react, there is no ability for the Surface Transportation Board to correct or to influence the railroads and how they act. It's set up on a series of letters. You come and sit in front of them just like I'm doing here today, and I will give you comments, and they'll write a letter to the surface to the railroads, and then the railroads will write them a letter back, and then another letter will come back, and they may do something. But the Surface Transportation Board can't do anything to them. And drilling down in their websites and finding out how much, and this is right from the Surface Transportation Board themselves, the committee people, right out of Washington. They said it's very hard to get the railroads to do what they request in their letters. And getting it done correctly and within a certain amount of time, and then they'll say they're working on it, like I've heard before. Not to dismiss your testimony, sir, but yes, I've heard that from the Transportation Surface Board and the railroads. They're working on it. I'm not a believer. I'm kind of a doubting Thomas on some of that stuff. Just because of the fact rail line service, speed of delivery and speed of cars has been reduced. And that's a known fact. The other concerns that we have, really frankly, are when we start putting all of this stuff on the roads, there's going to be an issue of safety also. You're going to have transportation safety issues that you may have to look at, larger truck sizes, all of that kind of stuff, sizes. And I don't know how long it takes to build a pipeline. I met with some people. But if you're looking at another pipeline, I would suggest very strongly that you go down existing corridors just for the permitting process and the streamlining of it, because frankly, try to get a pipeline across someplace is a real difficult task these days. And I'm not, you know, being flippant about that. That's just the reality of what happens these days. I want to thank you for having this committee. I am coming here, and I think it's a tremendous facility to the owners, the Hunt people, and I just congratulate you. You've got a lot of work ahead of you. Let's hope that this thing just irons itself out. Okay, and we'd all walk around in Bermuda shorts this summer, or this winter, I mean, and it'll be just fine. But having lived in Minnesota, I don't think that's going to happen. Frankly, if we can catch a break on this, we can catch up on some infrastructure build-out, and you're going to have to put some resources into this thing because it's a public domain, private situation. The issue of export really comes to our members. When we don't have the product here to use when we're cold and somebody else is moving it off, offshoring it or whatever you want to call it, exporting in different areas. I don't know if that's a state concern because of interstate and interstate commerce. The issue ends up being probably more at the federal level. U.S. senators and representatives should be talked to about that export and then also the propane strategic reserve. So thank you for your testimony. I'll stand for questions if you have any.
Thank you. I have one. You know, there's a way that maybe you could be helpful outside of this context. One of the things that Mr. Leiter and I talked about, and I'm sure a lot of other members talked about with the propane industry during session, is the federal regulations on energy assistance won't let us pay to fill people's tanks in the summer. And I know that the National Farmers Union probably has a lot more sway in the U.S. Congress than the Minnesota State Legislature. And so if you could filter up through your national organization the concern that we're going to be spending the money on energy assistance anyway. If you give states the flexibility and the freedom to purchase earlier in the season, we might be able to save some federal energy assistance dollars by pre-filling. So I know you're active in Farmers Union and maybe nationally, if you could bring that message
I'll bring
up.
It forward. We're having a fly-in this in September. We'll see all the state representatives, see all you guys in January, February. But we'll see all the senators and representatives from Minnesota with a delegation from Minnesota, about 45 people. And National Farmers Union brings in about 200 people every call just as Congress starts for specific issues, whether it's farm bill or implementation, or this propane thing is going to be very big for us, because it's going to cost money. And the issue is going to cost money, more money down the road if we don't do it now. So the issue of spending it out first, it's going to be cheaper later.
And we just can't do anything about that at the state level. If we even set up a fund and we paid early, the federal regs won't let us use the federal money to pay ourselves back. So I think your friends from Iowa, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, Illinois might have the same point of view. If everybody could be singing on the same sheet of music, that might help. Other questions for Mr. Peterson?
Well, very good. Thank you. And Senator Dibble, I look forward to working with you on some of the surface transportation stuff. And not to say, and I don't want to leave you with a negative thing about surface transportation, but I believe it used to be called something else, and then on deregulation it got to be surface transportation. If you look in that inside of that thing, I don't know if you like what you see. Okay, Senator.
I concur with your observation about the ability to affect the railroad companies and what they do and the speed at which they do it and whether or not they... So it definitely is going to take some partnership with our federal political leaders as well.
Yeah, and just one parting shot, excuse me. There may be, and I haven't got all of the information on it yet, there may be another issue on another pipeline not delivering propane into Minnesota. But I haven't fleshed that out yet. I'm just kind of hearing rumor thing, and it involves CHS and the railroads and this, Santa Fe also. So there might be one more shoe to drop for you, but I don't have all the details. Okay? Thank you very much.
Our next testifier is Tim Kavanaugh from Federated Co-op. And please feel free to sit and testify if you would like. We've got two standing testifiers, but you're certainly welcome to sit. Can you tell the car sound
about? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the Legislative Energy Commission.
My name is Tim Kavanaugh. I'm the general manager of Federated Co-ops. We're a diversified farm supply cooperative in east central Minnesota, but we've got a large propane customer base. 90% of our volume is home heat, although we do supply crop drying and some golden plump poultry barns also. I would like to thank the administration for spearheading the effort last winter on the extension of service waivers and the additional funding from LIHEAP. They were both important, and they were both important for us. As an industry, we've fought the imposition of a cold weather rule, which would have been especially harmful to the members of our cooperative and other cooperatives. We appreciate that the legislatures and the Dayton administration helped to head off the language and craft additional language. Federated is a not-for-profit entity. We're a price taker, and we deal with the market forces. We return any profits to our members, either in stock or in cash, and over the history of our company, we've paid back $100 million to the local economy. It might be interesting to some of you to know that although all the news media dealt with $5, $6 propane, Federated sold a lot of gallons of propane last year, and our average price was $1.879. We did sell some gallons for $4. It was a very short period of time, and it was at the peak of the crisis, but it only impacted a minimal amount of our customers, and we allowed those customers to take 100 gallons during that period of time. We've got limited resources at Federated, but I'd like to just point out a few of the long-term solutions we're working on. One is we have a new and creative programs that allow members to lock in prices. Obviously, that involves additional risk for our company, but we feel the impact to the customers will be good. Today, 99% of the questions we get about propane deal with price. Very few people call and say, are you going to have supply? That's amazing when your discussion here really deals with supply, and we are certainly concerned about that also. Federated invested in roughly $600,000 of additional propane storage and $500,000 of customer tanks, larger tanks that some of you have spoken about already. The Conan and Anderson sales tax exemption bill would have helped on those projects. Propane cost sharing grant would have been good on those projects also. I would like to thank Betsy Wergen, Commissioner Betsy Wergen, and the PUC for helping to get the variance process through on propane storage on the large facilities faster. Those were important, and Co-op Network worked with the PUC on that. Federated's also investing in additional transportation. We've got about $600,000 worth of propane trailers. Somebody, I think Roger, said the lead time on propane trailers is substantial. We ordered that in those trailers in January to get on the docket, and we expect to see delivery, as well as another $500,000 worth of equipment to deliver the propane to the customers. We think trucks are really going to be the answer this winter, and we've got 25 semi-trailers on the road during the winter period. One big cost for Federated is credit management. On a typical winter day, we're carrying $6 million worth of credit on propane. The LIHEAP funds are important, but they represent about 5% of our volume and typically about 10% of our accounts receivable offset on any given month. We, as you might well know, pay our propane suppliers almost at the time of delivery, and last winter a number of suppliers were asking for advance on the delivery. Rail transportation is important. Roger alluded to that. We have a rail terminal. We have for many years. It served us well. One of the issues on rail that I think both speakers before have talked about is that the timeliness of rail. We got 6 cars the other day. They took 10 days from Tioga, North Dakota on the Bakken, which would be a normal trip. They took 16 days to get from Minneapolis up to Cambridge. If that were to happen in the winter, we're talking about a month of lead time on those cars. And that's, I think, a serious issue. Last winter, we didn't depend on rail. This year, we've beefed up our rail cars higher. We hope that they arrive on time. Roger talked about CHS, their supplier. Those are really going to help also, the investments they've made in rail. I would like to make one comment on propane delivery. We did about 120,000 customer deliveries during last winter, during the cold months of the year. The coldest days, that was 1,000 deliveries a day. Many were small deliveries because of the pricing issue, as well as people just didn't have the money to pay for propane. So we lowered our minimums from 275-gallon minimums to 200, and then, as I said, when price got pretty high, we went down to 100 to help people out. Each delivery takes about 15 minutes for a driver. In those really cold days, the hose is hard, the snow was deep, took a little longer. We're legally required to do a leak check on every one of those deliveries that are out of gas, and there were a lot of them last winter. That extends the time that drivers could make deliveries during the day. Thought it might be interesting that when we were delivering 1,000 customers deliveries a day, and the Commerce Department put in the hotline, which we actually advocated and supported, we had 7 to 10 complaints on that hotline, all about price, high prices. And we had calls from Commerce saying, you've got 7 to 10 complaints on the hotline. 1,000 deliveries a day, 7 to 10 complaints. So I could only emphasize that we're going to do everything possible, as we did last year, to guarantee our contracts, lock in prices, deliver on the contracts. We did that last year. we care about our image, and certainly by no means did we do anything else other than try to guarantee the contracts that we had out there with customers. We expect to have more contracts this year, and we intend to honor all our contracts. We've made every effort to try to get the customers to fill their tanks early. Some of that comes down to they just don't have the money. You know, the customers that have the money are willing to fill their tanks. In fact, they're waiting for the pre-buy contracts to come out. I think your chairman talked about the LIHEAP funds. That would be a gigantic help. Last year we didn't get those dollars until the end of November, early December, so those tanks did not get filled, and that was right at the time when the cold weather arrived. And certainly the price had gone up by that time also, so the customer was getting less gallons for the dollars that they had available. I would like to thank all of you, the administration and the legislature, who took immediate action on this issue. There are no easy answers. I'm optimistic that the industry is doing everything they can to try to meet this challenge. I think the propane industry still has a very positive long-term outlook, and I think we can handle this situation. It's just that it requires some adjustments that none of us really had in our forecast a year or two ago. Thank you. Questions?
Thank you. Questions from members? Mr. Kavanaugh. Thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate it. Now from the state, we have Bill Grant from the Department of Commerce to give an update on the actions that the Dayton administration took last year and hopefully on a going forward basis to hear what's going on. Thanks for driving up to Brainerd.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks to Mr. Kavanaugh for breaking the mold on sitting rather than standing. So, Madam Chair and members, Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. I think we all know that the propane shortage last year and the high prices affected Minnesota families and businesses, farmers across the state. Over 213,000 households heat with propane. Most of that propane uses out here in greater Minnesota, where other alternatives aren't nearly as available, such as natural gas. This was last winter was, as I think everyone knows, the coldest winter in 30 years, and we found ourselves in a very bad situation. People have mentioned already on the record some of the prices that were being seen. We had a report at the department through our hotline of a price that reached $6.67. That was the highest that we heard, and it didn't last for long, but clearly when the average price for the product is under $2, that's a serious situation. So it creates a lot of stress and anxiety for people who heat with propane, particularly those who have a difficult time paying for that product. So I'll address all of these issues in just a few minutes here. This really was a wake-up call, I think, both to the state and to the industry that we needed to make some changes in our infrastructure and transportation for propane, not only here in Minnesota, but throughout the Midwest. Last fall, Governor Dayton called together the propane industry and stakeholders to discuss the closing of the Cochin pipeline, which, as has been testified here, brings in about 40% of our supply, to discuss how we might be able to manage that situation, of course not knowing at the time that that would be compounded by a very wet harvest and a very cold winter. We did identify at that time some of the transportation barriers that exist, but we felt confident at that point that we wouldn't be as severely impacted. And the winter clearly proved us wrong, and the perfect storm that people have talked about did in fact come to pass. We continue to offer assistance on behalf of Minnesotans in the same way we did during the crisis, to waive hours of service for truckers, to contact our federal counterparts and other state governmental leaders, to remove any barriers there might be to transportation or supply. But this will take a cooperative effort with industry to and all players to prevent this situation from happening again. And we at the department, in cooperation with the rest of the Dayton administration, will work with consumers on conservation efforts, weatherization efforts for low income, adding additional energy options. We're looking at solar thermal, for example, and natural gas service extensions, and exploring the Midwest Reserve or other possibilities for enhancing our storage of propane longer term. But this also means that the rail industry, the individual propane marketers, and others need to prioritize shipments and add storage. And as has been testified here, we do believe that a fair amount of activity is underway now for about steps that CHS has taken. We know that there have been improvements to the terminal at Benson. But the infrastructure concerns remain, and replacing 40% of our supply in a half season is probably not realistic. So the weather and the crop situation is going to play a large part in how difficult a winter we have coming up this year. Some of the state-level actions that we've taken since the crisis. One is, all of you know, was the work at the legislature on providing consumer protections for those who heat with propane. We sought to increase the transparency of pricing, prohibiting of extraneous fees, offering payment plans to all customers who heat with propane, assuring that customers can't be turned away because of their LIHEAP status, monitoring the supply and adding enforcement provisions within our powers, creating some notification of propane supply so that at the terminals so that we know when we're getting close to running out or when a difficult situation might be ahead, making sure that suppliers can't discriminate on the basis of the customer's LIHEAP status, and exploring alternative heating options. And there are several of those that appear promising. Not any one of them is going to take the place of that much of a loss of propane supply. So it is going to be a combination of enhancing supply and transportation options on the propane side and exploring other options where they exist. I believe you have a panel upcoming shortly on the natural gas situation as an example. In late May of this year, Commissioners Rothman, Fredrickson from Agriculture, Stein from Pollution Control, and Zelli from Transportation convened a stakeholder meeting to discuss the Cochin reversal and an update on supply and demand for 2014. This was an important step to hear and understand what the industry has been doing and will be doing to prevent another shortage in 2015. We believe the capacity is being added across the state. Rail expansions are underway to help transport propane, and the department has coordinated with other state agencies and the governor's office to address hurdles that may prevent storage construction. And you've heard about a couple of those situations. In Owatonna, we recommended to the Public Utilities Commission that they waive its requirement for a certificate of need for that storage, that large storage facility, so that construction could commence and be ready by this fall so that that storage could go into place. We had a similar situation with Dooley Petroleum, where there were a number of permits that appeared to be required from the Army Corps of Engineers. We worked closely with the Corps and the Pollution Control Agency to speed those along as much as possible. and waived the ones that weren't absolutely essential. In the area of LIHEAP, the department is sending out a letter this week that will come from all of the individual local service agencies to customers that received LIHEAP last year that were on propane, strongly encouraging them to do several things. First, to arrange for a summer fill if they're able to afford it. B, to take advantage of the fact that we send out applications to repeat customers early in the fall so that they can begin the process of completing their applications well before the federal money actually arrives, so that the very moment that we get the money that we're able to turn that around to their suppliers if they're found to be eligible. We will continue to reach out through a variety of mechanisms. We plan to be, for example, at FarmFest in a couple of weeks to talk about things that consumers in the farm community should be doing to be ready for the coming heating season. In addition, the department has inquired with the Federal Department of Human Services if LIHEAP money can be released earlier in the heating season. As you know, the answer was not what we were hoping for. We do want to extend our sincere thanks and appreciation to the legislature for its fast and overwhelming support for a supplemental appropriation at the very beginning of last session of $20 million to supplement the federal money. I can tell you that every last nickel of that money went out in the form of payments to those in need, and we would have been that much short this heating season, getting to the end of the heating season, without that supplemental appropriation. Of course, it wasn't just propane customers that were feeling the heat this year. With the cold weather, everyone's fuel bills were higher than normal. And so a large number of those who heat with fuel oil, with natural gas, and others were also assisted. But it really was essential in getting us through a very difficult winter. We also are working closely with railroads. We had a situation that I think it was mentioned by one of the earlier testifiers in Baudette, where and Representative Portman brought this to my attention, and we did work closely with the Senex representative, their co-op representative there. We think we've found a temporary solution to the problem, at least through this heating season, but it is an ongoing problem, and one that we're seeing elsewhere too, where railroads are not anxious, given the volume that they're moving on their lines, to drop small shipments of propane where they customarily have. And that could exacerbate an already difficult situation. I want to just leave people with the understanding, and I mentioned this before, that with the reversal of the Cochin pipeline and the loss of 40% of our supply, it's unlikely, if we have the same scenario developed this winter as did last, that we'd be in a very much better situation. I think we would be in a somewhat better situation given all the activity that we have, but it's going to be difficult to replace that much supply in that short amount of time. So this is an ongoing problem, one that's going to require your attention, attention of the administration, and attention of the industry for some time to come. In the meantime, early fills, good management practices, weatherization where clients are eligible, utilization of alternative energy sources, efficient appliances, heating appliances especially, and, yes, good weather will all be important in the coming year. So I'm happy to take any questions that the committee might have.
If you could just briefly describe what was the situation in Baudette and what you think the short-term solution you've arrived at.
Sure.
They've arrived at it.
Sure. The situation there was the local terminal, it's a Senex terminal, has been supplied for a long time by Canadian National Railroad. And the general manager there was informed a month or so ago that the railroad was no longer willing to continue making shipments at its terminal, and gave the reason that the terminal was, for some reason, out of compliance with federal safety standards. Apparently, the loading device was too far away from where the railroad, with the tracks, actually came through. And we're certainly not the only folks that intervened on this, but we did reach out to the Department of Transportation, asked them to prepare a letter to the Surface Transportation Board, asking them to look into the situation. The governor has also prepared a letter to send to the railroad to encourage them to not take this action. And as I understand it, the railroad has agreed to allow deliveries to continue there through April of this coming year. They've made no promises about what might happen beyond that. And so that's an ongoing problem, one that will probably require further action. And some of the concerns about the reach of the Surface Transportation Board, I would echo. They have very little power other than arm twisting with the railroads to try and get them to change whatever practice they might have. So it is a difficult situation.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Grant. A lot of questions, but I'll start with one, and then time permits, I'll ask another one later if someone else gets to ask. On weatherization and conservation and efficiency measures, particularly for low-income households, can you just give us a sense of how big is the challenge and how much progress have we made?
Sure.
I mean, in real practical terms, because it feels like an ocean of a problem that we've only put a few drops into.
That's, thank you for that question, Senator Dibble. Yes, and you're absolutely right. In Minnesota, throughout most of the state, we have an aging housing stock. Much of it has not been properly weatherized, particularly the homes of low-income Minnesotans. Our estimate is that of all of the folks that have been weatherized since the program began, we've probably been able to weatherize somewhere between 5 and 10% of the homes that are eligible for weatherization assistance. And that includes the number of homes that we were able to weatherize during the stimulus period, where we ramped up well beyond where what our normal levels of activity were, and were able to weatherize at a much faster pace than we had been. That, of course, has now gone back to kind of where we were pre-era levels, and in a good year, we have somewhere between $12 and $17 million available to weatherize thousands and thousands of homes at a couple of thousand dollars apiece. So the money just does not go as far as we would like it to. There are certainly more people on waiting lists waiting for weatherization services than we're able to supply.
Just one quick follow-up on the same subject. So if we're able to get in and weatherize someone's home, how much of the problem does that solve in terms of addressing the gap they have in being able to pay their utility bill?
Sure. And Karen Moe might be able to help me out with this from the CAP Association too. But typically a good weatherization job is going to save 20% of the customer's heating bill. So if your bill was, just hypothetically $100 a month, you might be able to reduce it to $80. But if you were having trouble paying anything towards your heating bill, there still remains a considerable gap.
Senator Newell.
Do we have any, so we just had a great presentation a couple buildings over. Is there requirements? Never mind. I guess there's not. I mean, we just, anyone who's eligible for LIHEAP, to the extent that the money's available, we make that available to them. What is the process by the criteria by which we determine whose home we go to and otherwise?
Right. And Senator Bigel, are you getting at, is there any interplay between our weatherization assistance and our energy assistance
yes.
programs?
Yeah. Thank you.
So thanks for the clarification.
Yeah.
The programs really do operate somewhat independently of each other,
right.
If the same income guidelines for eligibility apply, if you're eligible for LIHEAP, then you are eligible for weatherization services. But people are taken, for the most part, on a first-come, first-served basis.
Any other questions from Senator Marty?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This went back to the supply. You have unknown of how much the demand is going to be this year,
right?
The supply, we're talking about how much more capacity is being put in how many places. We don't know how full these things are. We don't know how prepared we are. What do we need to know?
Right.
Fill that gap in as much as we can.
We don't know with precision how much storage existed prior to the on private facilities prior to the crisis, nor after the crisis. We don't know how much of that as a percentage has been filled this summer versus last summer. And some of that kind of information is the sort of information we were seeking in statute last year. Obviously, it's difficult to compel thousands of private citizens to supply information. So what would be helpful is having a better sense from the industry about what the fill rate is that they're seeing. And I think that we've worked cooperatively with Mr. Leiter and his association to obtain as much of that information as is available. As we've both said and testified here, we think that we're starting this winter in a better place than we were in last year, because we really have been ringing the bell pretty hard about filling early and taking advantage of both supply and price situation in the summer versus the winter. But I can't sit here and tell you exactly how much better a situation we're in than we were last year. I know it's better than it was.
And is there, Madam Chair, is there anything we can do to enhance that more, or is it just going to be an unknown on both demand and unknown on the supply side?
Well, I believe, Mr. Chair, that we continue to look at our existing authority under statute to collect information from the industry and other sources, and to the extent that we feel that that authority needs to be enhanced, we may very well be asking you to consider language along those lines.
And the authority that we put in the law to get information from the terminals, that is just to let you know at the Department of Commerce when they're low, right? So
that's
you
correct.
Will only hear from them once a problem starts to develop?
That's, Madam Chair, that's exactly right. And I don't have the language in front of me, but it is kind of, if you're a week away from being out of fuel, then you need to notify us. Obviously, that doesn't help much if the supply can't be arranged in that amount of time.
Any other questions from members for Mr. Grant?
Thanks again for
Thank
traveling
you.
Up here, and
happy
nice
to
of you to wear a suit. We didn't all observe the dress code today, but
not much longer.
Next on our agenda, we have Betsy Morgan from the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission to talk a little bit about the natural gas extensions and what the PUC has been doing with regard to that. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. See if it, thank you for inviting me, Chairs Hartman and Marty. It's good to see so many of you again and to meet those that I haven't in the past. So it's good to be here. And I want to start by giving just a little shout out to the Public Utilities Commission staff, because I've been on vacation and they put these slides together via telephone and poor Annie waited so patiently to get them, but they made it and we're here, so we're thankful to have the opportunity. I'm going to just give you a real quick overview of the Public Utilities Commission, only because I think there's a lot of people that don't know what we do. And our role is considerably different from that of most agencies. As most of you know, we are appointed by the governor. There are five commissioners, and we serve staggered six-year terms, not more than three from any one political party in order to maintain balance. And at least one has to be from outside of the Twin Cities metropolitan area. I'm going to put in a little plug for making sure that that stays, because it is helpful when you get to something like this to have someone who understands the propane issue in the rural areas, who understands the agricultural community, who understands how rural co-ops work. And so there are a lot of connections with the Public Utilities Commission that would get a little bit lost if you had all five members that have never worked with any of those entities. So I have always appreciated that that's part of it. And we can be removed from our office, of course, only for cause. We have statutory functions that cross the borders of quasi-judicial, which means that our decisions are made based on a formal record. It's interesting. All the testimony is taken, for the most part, when it's in front of a hearing officer, a hearing judge. It's sworn testimony when it's in front of us. There's an expectation of truthfulness as well. We are legislative in that we promulgate rules as a result of statute, and we are administrative in that we investigate and enforce and represent Minnesota in national and regional forums. And there are so many arenas in which that happens. And Minnesota, by the way, has an excellent reputation nationally from the Public Utilities Commission and from the legislative permission to enter that national arena with information and sharing ideas and things like that. So we appreciate those opportunities as well. Our responsibilities are primarily to ensure safe, adequate, and reliable service at fair and reasonable rates for the three critical industries, electricity, natural gas, and local telephone service, and to determine the need and physical location for large energy facilities. When we talk about large energy, there are a lot of very small things that we don't regulate, which is just fine. But things like transmission lines over 100 kV and over 10 miles in length, or generation over 50 megawatts, are regulated by the Public Utilities Commission. We also have a Consumer Affairs Office, and that Consumer Affairs Office takes over 30,000 public calls every year and mitigates over 2,000 complaints from the public between a person or a household and their utility, whether it be natural gas, telephone, or electricity. And we foster effective telephone competition. The one thing that doesn't get mentioned often is if you look at electricity and natural gas, although they're two very different things, the interdependency between the two is getting greater and greater, in that there is more and more electricity generated by virtue of natural gas, which takes pipeline space and causes a lot of demand on pipelines and leads to a little bit less flexibility for the space on those pipelines, because it has to be dedicated to certain services. So that's an important piece. And I have just one slide about propane so that you see how we get here. The only role that we play in propane is that the storage facilities exceeding 100,000 gallons or increasing their capacity by 20% are subject to having to obtain a certificate of need. And after seeing what happened this past winter and hearing what a priority it was for the legislature, we did indeed grant a one-year variance from that certificate of need. And there are no variance requests waiting at this point in time, because they have all been granted in order to hopefully make this winter a little bit better scenario by virtue of having more storages in places such as CHS and others that you heard about today. The structure of the natural gas sector in the U.S., and this is not to be confused with the oil pipelines. For instance, the Sandpiper and the Enbridge pipeline are oil pipelines that we regulate the routing and siting for, but natural gas is a completely different topic when it comes to what we do. And as you can see from this slide, it's quite multifaceted. There are portions of the natural gas sector that are not regulated at all, for instance, pricing on the wells and things like that, or some of the gathering. There are some states that do regulate the collector systems, but we don't have to worry about that here. And then there is a great portion that is regulated by the federal government, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and the Department of Transportation. And then there is the portion that's regulated by the state, such as the state of Minnesota, which is essentially the distribution and the retail sale of the natural gas industry. There are 1,200 distributors throughout the U.S., but there are 6 regulated distributors in the state of Minnesota. And just to let you know a little bit what we do with natural gas at the Public Utilities Commission, at this point in time for open dockets, we have 3 open rate cases for natural gas. They are with CenterPoint Energy, with Merck, and with Xcel. All 3 of them have rate cases open. We have 2 other cases. One is for a distribution lateral in the Holding Ford area, and one is for an agricultural pipeline to West Central Ag Services. And so those are issues that I can't talk about because they're open dockets, but you do need to know that we're working on them. We also have the new area surcharges that we're working on, and I'll have a slide about those a little bit later on. This shows you the interstate pipelines as they go through Minnesota. You can see Northern Natural Gas, you can see Viking, you can see Great Lakes. They are all very large systems that flow across the state of Minnesota in one area or another, whether it be a huge part of the state or just a small, like in the southwestern quarter there with the northern border state pipeline. This is the Northern Natural Gas Pipeline. Oh boy, it's harder to see up there than it is on the one in front of me. You can see, however, that it does come all the way from Texas, travels all the way through up to northern Minnesota, and it has many, many branches off from it. This is our largest interstate system that comes into Minnesota, the Northern Natural Gas Pipeline. And, of course, off from that you have several entities that are purchasing and distributing to town border stations and to individual residences and commercial businesses. We have, like I said, 6 natural gas regulated utilities. They are CenterPoint Energy, Xcel Energy, Minnesota Energy Resources Corporation, Great Plains, Iowa Power and Light, and Greater Minnesota Gas. And we do have an exception, too, with small exempt natural gas companies. In other words, if you own a distribution company for natural gas that serves less than 650 customers on one system, then you are not regulated by the Public Utilities Commission. And you can have multiple systems, but the total cannot be more than 2,000 customers between all of your systems. So either 650 on a single system or 2,000 as a whole, and you may remain unregulated in that particular case. And then, of course, there are municipal gas companies, and I'm not going to talk about those at all, except that, to the best of my knowledge, there are 31 of them in the state of Minnesota. The characteristics of a local natural gas service in Minnesota. Natural gas is different than telephone in that there is no carrier of last resort. There is a federal ruling that everyone must have access to a telephone line. However, there's nothing about a natural gas line, and for very good reason. But that is the case, that there is no universal service obligation, because there are just plain cases where it is not practical at all to have natural gas, where propane, fuel oil, and some other things make a lot more sense. And some of those things are caused by interstate pipeline locations. If you don't have an interstate pipeline within 30 miles of where you want to be served so that the distribution come off from it, there's no way that it's financially feasible to put that pipeline in to a single residence or a single business, so it doesn't make sense in that case to have natural gas. Geographic and environmental issues. There are areas where you simply can't cross the rivers, you can't cross the wetlands, and you can't cross the forest because it's cost prohibitive and it interrupts the natural environment in too great a way to be a practical thing to do. And so that's another reason that some areas are not served by natural gas. And, of course, because of those two things, the economic concerns come into play. Who's going to pay for it if you have to put in a 30-mile line and things like that? So those are the reasons that there is no requirement for natural gas to be a service that everyone has. There are, however, service extension policies that we need to follow. When we look at service extensions for natural gas, we have to look at them in light of the fact that anyone requesting a new extension should not be a burden on those already existing customers. In other words, if Senator Dibble requests a natural gas pipeline to his home and it's, let's say, a quarter of a mile off from the road, his neighbors shouldn't pay for that. That should be paid for by the new customers that come on that line. And so that's one of the criteria we look at. Utility tariffs also specify that there is free footage allowance. In other words, to get from the road in front of your house to your house, and it's different for the different companies, but they may have something like the first 100 feet of the extension towards your home is free, but your house is 177 feet, you may have to pay for the last 77 feet. So they each do have a free footage allowance, and then the rest is paid for by the customer. And customer extensions that do not qualify, that would be that last 77 feet, have to pay for that themselves. New area service charges, and this is where this comes into play with this issue that we're talking about today and with the legislature's desire for more folks where it's possible to be served economically feasible by a new natural gas service. So it might be something like a small rural town in a more remote area. And then what happens is that it's determined that the customers, the new customers coming on the system, pay the same base cost for the existing service as the customers that already are on the system. So again, if I'm already on the system and Senator Dibble wants a new service, he would pay that same base cost that I do on my existing service. And so that is shared, but then there's a new incremental cost of the extension by virtue of a new area surcharge. And that new area surcharge can then be paid back over a number of years. And that's determined by what the projected cost for the project is. If we're going to serve, if a company is going to serve a new town that has 170 homes and they're going to go into that, there's a determination made as to how much it'll cost to build out that system. And then what the bonding, et cetera, is, and how much each customer has to pay on a monthly basis over a determined period of time to pay back the cost of that extension on top of the cost for their basic service. And it has been determined that in some cases, even with the new area service charges that we're looking at, some customers will save up to $1,000 in 1 year by adding natural gas, even with a new area surcharge on their bill. So there are areas where it's very practical, especially under the current circumstances, to bring natural gas out. But, of course, it takes time to build as well. And what they do, the surcharges are paid and they are kept close track of so that as soon as the system is paid for, if it was determined that it would take 20 years to pay back that new area, that to pay back the amount that it costs to put in that infrastructure, but the infrastructure is paid for in 18 years, the company does not continue to collect it for 20. The collection of that new area surcharge stops, so that the people's bill goes down accordingly and they only pay the amount that was determined in the beginning that they would pay for the extension of that natural gas service. There's some examples of natural gas, of new area surcharges that are taking place right now, well, that have taken place in recent history and are taking place now. CenterPoint Energy did some work in the Alexandria Lakes area in the 1990s under a new area surcharge. Xcel Energy did a Brainerd Lakes area surcharge project in the 1990s. And Xcel currently has one pending in Barnesville, Holdingford, and Pillager. These would be new towns served by natural gas by Xcel Energy by virtue of a new area service charge. And some of those folks it has been determined could save as much as $1,000 over propane in the coming heating season should they be able to get this in place, even with their new area surcharge. Now, Minnesota Energy Resources Corporation, or MERC, also has a new area surcharge pending for an area near Ely Lake in the cities of Eveleth and Gilbert. So it's not exclusive to one part of the state or the other either. It's pretty much rural areas in smaller towns or smaller cities that need the extension of the natural gas, but again, only where it's economically practical. There are also new area surcharges for some municipalities. The city of Battle Lake did a new area surcharge authorized by the city council for a 9-mile extension, and it was $3.4 million, and the project begins service this fall in Battle Lake and those surrounding areas. And so there are city examples where the city council is taking on that responsibility as well. And with that, I wanted to make sure I left time for questions so you could ask the things that you really want to hear from me instead of me just babbling on and boring you this afternoon. So if there's anything I can answer, I'd appreciate it.
Well, I have one question. So for those areas that are adding natural gas service to customers that were traditionally on propane, do you know, do they have to buy a different furnace?
Most often. It would be unusual that they'd have to buy a different furnace unless their furnace was quite old. Most of the more recent furnaces, you can change from a natural gas regulator to from a propane regulator to a natural gas regulator. For instance, when we built the house that we're in, there was no natural gas at that particular time when we built the house, but there is now. And so when the natural gas service came in, we had to change out a part in our furnace and in our hot water heater in order to use natural gas rather than propane. And I don't know exactly what that cost would be right now, but I believe it was about $80 per appliance at the time that we did it. But it could vary, of course, with how the age of the system and things like that. And I'm sure guys like Roger and the others in the audience would know better what those costs would be.
Just since you went through the experience, do you recall your energy bill going down when you switched from propane to natural gas when it was piped into your area?
It did, but the prices weren't nearly as different, of course, as this past winter. I want to say at that point in time, we were probably paying like $1.20. We always pre-bought. We were blessed enough to be able to do that. So we would pre-buy when we felt that the company had offered us the lowest price possible. And then that would help a lot, too. So there wasn't a huge difference for us, but there was a difference. But the second difference comes in that you don't have to have it plowed out so that they can get back to the tank. You don't have to make sure that you're getting filled in the middle. There are a lot of things with propane that you have to manage that you don't necessarily have to manage with natural gas. Although I have to say the propane companies have done great things with automatic fills and that type of thing with their budgeting that they do. So it's changed quite a bit from when we did it too.
Just clearing a snow path, that's huge.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, thanks. I was curious when you talked about how some of these customers in the last year and next year could save $1,000 or so in heating bills even after paying the surcharge. I'm just curious, assuming propane doesn't go off the charts in expense again, are there a lot of communities that you think would fall into the category where this is possible in the next 5 years or so?
Commissioner Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, I really wouldn't want to venture a guess as to how many communities, but I do know that the gas companies are taking a very fresh look at it. You've got to figure that if it's going to be economically possible for them to make a profit in extending to that next community, they're going to do it. But what has helped a lot is in the rural areas, some of the larger grain dryers, some of the larger farmers are requesting extension, which then by virtue of them, because of the large quantity they use, it becomes more economically possible for the small town to have the benefit as well. So there's sort of a hand-in-hand with agriculture and the community that they live and work in.
Other questions from members?
Senator Sundin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, Commissioner. Commissioner Wergert, and I think I know the answer to this. I just don't know why, and maybe it's just history. You, the Commission, are involved in electrical rate cases, I think frequently or at least occasionally, and so on and so forth. You don't likewise, though, monitor prices on fuel. Do you use propane or natural gas?
We do rate cases on natural gas. We have 3 open rate cases right now for natural gas. However, we don't do anything with the price of propane. That's not really.
Further questions? Senator Dibble.
Except the fuel price in the rate is assumed. Is that correct?
I'm sorry?
The fuel price itself in the rate, natural gas is assumed.
The fuel price is actually a pass-through. Right. When we're doing the rate setting, I guess you could say we're more or less setting the base cost of what the service is, because the actual gas itself is passed through on the bill and a fuel charge as allowed by a rider on the bill.
Any other questions from members? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your willingness to travel with us today.
Thank you.
I apologize, but I have to leave early and chair another meeting at home.
Thank you.
Our next testifier is Chris Conrad from Xcel Energy to talk about some of the expansion work that Xcel Energy is doing. And thanks to you too for being here. I know it's probably a busy time for you, and I appreciate the time out of your day to educate us on what's going on.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Commission. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm Chris Conrad with Xcel Energy. I work in our account management area, and in that area we have some gas business development team, along with account managers that work with other business customers. What I'd like to do is just go over some natural gas expansion that we've seen in the past year. In Minnesota, there's some larger natural gas providers. Northern States Power has the Lime Green area, for the most part, and some other providers there. We talked about Minnesota Energy Resources up there and Center Point. In Minnesota, you can see that natural gas is, a lot of the households already have it. The yellow line is propane, and that's, it's grown steadily over the years, but it is more prevalent in the rural area, along with some other fuels like electric heating and wood and other materials. For Xcel Energy, we took a look at where's the more densely populated propane areas, and we targeted a couple with the variance in price between natural gas and propane. There was an opportunity to maybe introduce the concept of extending natural gas to some towns. Throughout the winter, we gave presentations in Holdingford, Barnesville, Pillager, and we've talked with the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe and Walker and some other areas. We were successful in getting the towns of Holdingford, Barnesville, and nearby Pillager to agree to natural gas extension in 2014. So over the years, we've done, through a newer area surcharge rider, we've been able to do the Brainerd area, Taylor's Falls, Glendon. And we really haven't done much in the past 15 years because the price of propane and natural gas have been relatively close, but with the fracking and other, the shale, ability, natural gas reserves have grown and the price has become more stabilized. And it's created an opportunity. So this year we're working on Barnesville, Holdingford, and Pillager. Also, there's been a little bit of an uptick in some building for residential construction. But what really helps, and we've heard this before, Commissioner Wergen and some other speakers said, you need an anchor. If you have an anchor site like a grain dryer, an asphalt plant, or a poultry barn, that can kind of help make your decision, do you bring gas to the nearby town? So we look for an anchor. Xcel Energy has facilities that help us with peaking. So we have peaking plants that will allow us to not have to take out such a large demand capacity for the very coldest days. We can inject, or start up our peaking plants to help offset the peak loads. We design our systems for minus 30 degrees, and that gives us an advantage in keeping our costs lower. For a typical residential natural gas customer, we try to get them natural gas at about $1 a gallon propane equivalent. And, you know, here's an example. The new area surcharge to extend gas to a customer is typically, we found that most customers seem to buy into about a $25 a month surcharge, which is about $311 a year. The normal rate for a residential customer, there's a $9 service charge that covers the metering and the service from Xcel. And then they typically use about 1,000 therms a year, similar to 1,000 gallons of propane. And our average cost, because gas is a pass-through for us and we buy a pretty large quantity, is about 67 cents a therm. So all in all, it's about about a little over 1,000 a year for a heating season, which equals about $1.09 a therm, which equates to about 99 cents a gallon for propane. If we can deliver that, we can usually be competitive with a customer. And what we need to find out is if we can make the investment, run the extension lines, and be able to make the project economical where it fits into our regulated models and we get cost recovery. So what we found, and then also on commercial customers, they have a little bit more of a threshold because they use more. The all-in cost, even at 99 cents a gallon equivalent propane, they can withstand a little bit more of a monthly area surcharge of up to $100 a month. Their service charge for small commercials is a little higher, and their use is a little bit more. With that use being a little bit more, their average price is a little lower. But again, the dollar a gallon equivalent propane is kind of what we've seen the customer threshold. So the typical gas extension, the tipping point is about $25 a month surcharge. If you get up more than that, it gets to be challenging for customers because you've got that surcharge, for the month of July here, and you've got your monthly meter charge. So throughout the year, you're paying at least $34, $35, even if you're not using gas or not to a large extent, maybe for some water heating. So customers seem to have that threshold of about $25. The customers incur the cost of the project through their town, through the new area surcharge. Non-participants typically do not incur project costs. There's costs for appliance conversion. You have to convert your furnace, and oftentimes you have to replace your water heater. You can try to convert it. You may have to replace your furnace if you're using a fuel oil or some other type of other than propane. For the regulatory side, if we can't make the $25 a month surcharge work for 25 years based on the number of people in town or who we think we can convert, there is a requirement for a contribution to native construction if our model doesn't show that there's sufficiency after, generally it's after 7 or 8 years. We run a 40-year model, but we have to show sufficiency after 7 or 8 years. So there are options. Other states have helped with appliance conversion or some grants or a rural tariff that allows you to have a little bit more for extension costs or build a little bit more in. The gas business development team, we have dedicated points of contact. In the three towns we're doing, Barnesville, Holdingford, and Pillager, we'll have a gas representative or two in those towns to work with residential customers to let them know that this is how much is covered in your extension, and if you have a really long driveway, you need to pay so much more per foot, and if you want to change where you want the normal meter is, this is the cost. And then we get those folks signed up, we get the paperwork processed. So it's a lot of work. A big thing that we're running into this year is the trained and qualified construction crews. We've pretty much contracted every crew that's available for the three towns we're doing, and they need to be certified and be able to do the welds and everything up to the standards that we require. So that's gotten a little tighter this year. And one area that we're doing is nearby Pillager, down the road here. And when we do a town, I mentioned that you want to try to get as many customers along the route as possible. And just to give you an example, when you kind of look at one of these towns, if you're running from, you try to look where you're going to run from, and you try to pick up the pink line here indicates, where the different towns we're going to. So if you start over in the Baxter area and you try to pick up some customers, there's really four phases to the project. So you try to pick up as many customers as you can along the way. And it helps to have some larger customers, grain dryers, turkey farms, schools. They help to, make the economics more feasible. But we do appreciate the opportunity, and any other questions we can provide, we'll be happy to do so.
Questions from members? Senator
DeVos. A couple questions. The contribution and aid of construction, from whom does that come?
That would come from the customer, typically it's from a large commercial customer. There might be a turkey farm, and so say,
is it a lump sum?
Generally, it is.
Right.
In addition to new area surcharge.
I see.
Senator Nibble.
And then as you're looking to build out, for example, in Pillager or these others, do you need a certain threshold of individual residential customers to say yes before you proceed?
What we do is we look at the town and the customers on propane and the ability to convert those customers. Meet so many. Our model figures 70% the first year, and then another 20%, and then 10%. But what we do is we'll have a couple community meetings and smaller examples in Scandia, where there's a section of customers that still are on propane, and we did the model there and said we really need there's 90 customers still on propane. We really need 50 of you to say yes. And be able to pay this surcharge and then this monthly facility charge.
Right.
And until we get 50, we really can't do the project. Right. So we do kind of, on smaller ones, we do look at that as well.
How many new customers will you have in Pillager? Is there a range?
Well, Pillager is, we have four sections along the way, and our hope is to really get about 800 or 900 customers. In the town of Pillager, there might be 600 or 500 customers. But we're trying to pick up other customers along the way. Same way with Barnesville, we're hoping to get about 800 or 900 customers.
Is there an agricultural facility in Barnesville that serves as an anchor?
Yes, there's a big grain dryer, and there's a colony, a Hutterite colony, and then the normal schools and other options there as well.
Question about the workforce, the trained and qualified construction crews. Where do they come from? Who are they?
We often use contract crews, Q3 and some other ones that we have relationships with and that are certified to do work. We have each town we're using some of our crews and some contract crews. And they're typically crews we've used year over year, but there are crews that we've pulled in from other areas like Colorado that we've used a little bit out there. We often test their what they've done, their welds, and they've got to meet our specifications. But for the three projects we're doing this year and with other normal work, we've pretty much maxed out crews for this summer. So it has been a little challenging.
So is it safe to say that we kind of hoped, I think, last winter was that the challenge we had with propane would really open the doors to building out a lot more natural gas and really relieving
pressure on this whole propane situation. It sounds like we're only going to be able to really address the margins, some of the propane pressure as a whole. It's not going to be the big solution that we had hoped for.
How much of a dent are you making in Rogers members' business?
It does take time, right? Everything takes a little time, but we're enthusiastic about it, and we think if they're close to our system now, it makes a lot of sense. And there's a lot of customers near our main that we can add. We've had 16,000 different prospects that we've mailed to year after year, and only a few of them have signed up. But now it's starting to pick up. You know, there's more of a gap there between. The two prices for fuels.
Do you know if any of the other natural gas suppliers in Minnesota are adding turf, like you're adding Pillager and Barnesville on the southern end of the state? Are we seeing similar action from other natural gas providers?
I'm not sure. I know that we've looked at some other areas, and we're looking to see what we can do with the resources we have and the people. Since we haven't really added a lot of big towns in about 15 years, we don't have the staff we once had. So we're trying to beef up with contract folks and get people up to speed. But I don't know. I know that CenterPoint is going after a few things, but others I'm not really sure of.
And I think Senator Skoy might want us to ask, with all the flaring that's going on in North Dakota, is there any discussion about additional natural gas being piped toward Minnesota so that it doesn't have to be flared? Is it getting to the point where it'd be cost competitive to put it in a pipeline and bring it here and sell it to customers?
That's a good question. I know Northern Border runs some Bakken gas down through North Dakota into South Dakota, and we looked at where our engineers are looking at many different options of tapping into that line and what it would mean, but it really you need an anchor industry or maybe gas fired generation or something like that to really pull that along with serve other customers. There's a lot of for example, on this Pillager line, we're running 39 miles of pipeline. So it just there's a lot of coverage you have to do. And Walker, we're looking at that area, but there's pockets here, pockets there. It really is tough to make the economics work. And then when you connect to an interstate pipeline, there's a town border station that needs to be built that's usually $1 million or more. And so, yeah, it gets to be costly.
And my last question is one that I think Representative Mahoney would want me to ask, which is on those work crews, do you have welders and you have pipe fitters, or what sort of construction folks are helping you bring these pipelines in?
Yeah, we work.
Can I add to that?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And then that'll be my last question. I didn't quite finish my workforce question, so as a part of her question, do we anticipate that there will be enough expansion statewide so that we have something to think about in terms of workforce development to develop these kinds of skills in the market?
I can speak to my area. I'm in really the marketing and sales, but operations is, meetings with operations. We have operational meetings once a week, and we hear different things about we've got crews maxed out. We've got to bring crews in from other areas, to get the right trained. A lot of the new extensions are being through a high density polyethylene piping that's been proven, and there's a special way to weld that, and you've got to know how to do it, and we do a lot of inspections with that. It's more economical to bring gas to areas that way rather than running a lot of costly steel pipe. It's been done a lot in other areas, and so you've got to make sure that they have the ability to do things right.
And so where does that, where that training occurs? Does it occur in the technical colleges? Does it occur through the contractors, the apprenticeship? Where does that?
I would imagine in the technical colleges and with the contractors. I'm not exactly sure on how that all comes together.
Yeah, if you could ask your operational people, when they run a help wanted ad, does it say help wanted welders, help wanted pipe fitters? What sort of skilled labor are you looking for in that?
Okay.
We'd be interested in. And also if there's a projection for the future. I think it's worth it for us to talk to our higher ed chairs about making sure those programs are supported. Any other questions? Senator Sandman.
You may be alluded, but can you just generally give us a cost, a mile of pipe cost, how much?
It depends on the area, but
generally, you know, just
Jerry, would you have a soil?
Yeah, you know, my average cost of pipe per foot runs about $20 a foot. It's like cost.
And that's in the hole, right?
Yeah.
That's labor cost, everything.
Yeah, that's the most cost.
Okay.
No, the services are separate from that. But, well, yeah, no. That's kind of a, based on a 75-foot service, and one beyond that, we collect an additional fee, so yes.
Ms. Levinson-Falk has a question.
Thank you. One of the things Commissioner Worgen mentioned was the increasing uses for natural gas, especially electric generation. Do you have a sense of how much capacity there is on the various interstate pipelines that you pull off of? I mean, is there a lot of extra space and you could build, you know, dozens of these community extensions, or are you going to start running up to the peak capacity of those pipelines and need to think about building others?
That's a real good question. It does vary, but on pipelines like Viking, there is capacity. On other pipelines like WBI in North Dakota, there isn't much capacity. Northern Natural often needs 18 months notice if they need to expand. There is a notice period, but for the projects we've done this year, it's coming off of Viking and there has been the capacity.
Any other questions?
Can I address that pipeline capacity?
Sure. Can you say your name and your affiliation?
Mike Warren, Northwest Gas, working in the natural gas and equipment business. What's happening on a more macro scale here is all the pipes, and I'm sure you'd agree with this, that traditionally brought gas from Western Canada east and from the west to the east. The Marcellus Shale there has brought online so much natural gas. Those pipes are having a hard time being full. So 10 years ago, Northern Border, Great Lakes, even Viking, which comes off Trans-Canada, Trans-Canada itself, are much more agreeable. They got a lot more space because the gas that they used to haul to the East Coast is getting backed up by the Marcellus Shale. So, you know, there's really a ton of capacity available. Trans-Canada is even thinking about converting one of their four transcontinental lines away to bring crude to the East Coast because they're not full of gas. So
thank you. That's helpful information.
Less of an issue on Northern because there's a lot of shale in Texas. And that's
thank you for your testimony. Sure. Thanks again for traveling. Our next testifier is Gary Greenhut, the mayor of Pillager. I don't know if I'm saying that at all right.
You got it pretty close.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to address the Commission this afternoon on behalf of Pillager. Just a little background very quickly. We're 12 miles west of Brainerd on Highway 210 in southern Cass County. Our latest population figure puts us at 459 people in the community. A little bit of demographics. Our median per capita income is $20,000 a year. Our household median is about $34,000. We have 190 households and 144 families. So when energy prices spike, it makes a difference. The people that I talked to this winter, pretty much frustration and resignation because there was nothing on the horizon at that time. So when XL contacted us, it was a welcome contact, just from the point of view that we had another option for the people in the community to look to. So I guess our feeling was as a board was if they can make it work and it's the cheapest route, then they'll succeed. So, it's difficult when people ask you what you can do, and there's really, you know, so I was very happy to see this. XL has been excellent to work with. They've been very forthcoming in what they can do and what they can't do, and been notifying the people, keeping them informed. They had a community meeting here a couple weeks ago and had very good interest in it. So hopefully that'll translate into some business for them. There's a little bit of a, given the short construction season in Minnesota, we had to move fairly quickly. We reviewed the franchise agreement, which is for 20 years. The only really decision we had to make as a board was whether or not we were going to charge a fee, a city fee on top, and we decided not to. Just, it was enough the way it was, I think. The other thing we had to do was review our right-of-way ordinance. We had to revisit that just because there's getting to be a lot of things buried in right-of-ways now. So we had to review that and just make sure that we had that up to date and ready to go. So we moved as quickly as we could, met as often as we could legally, and tried to get it expedited as quickly as we could. So as far as from a city point of view, it's been a pretty easy process, actually. Yeah.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions from members? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Mayor, when will it be in? When will these people be making the switch?
Well, hopefully this will be in the city by the end of this construction season. That's our hope. So it's,
what kind of, are you hearing from your constituents in terms of typical propane bills last year? I mean, I know it varies a lot based on the public school.
They went up probably three times. Yeah. So it was significant. So it was really nice to have another option.
Senator Sandin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. I'm just thinking, is this optional for the residents? And my real question is there an assessment or a deferred assessment?
No.
On the residents? There's not.
No, okay. Senator, there's not. They can either choose to hook up or not. It'll go down the right-of-way in front of their property. And they can hook up or choose not to, or hook up at a later date.
Okay.
So there is no assessment. No?
Other questions from members?
So sorry if I missed it. What percentage of your residents are opting in?
At this point, I'm not exactly sure. I know there's a lot of interest in it, but I'm not exactly sure how many. Hopefully, quite a few. And I hope so that we can, and I believe it was brought up earlier that if we can pay the project off in less than 20 years, then that surcharge will go away at that point. So that would be beneficial.
So if more opt-in, does that amortization schedule, that financing period, shorten?
Yes.
Mr. Mayor, are you going to be a new customer receiving natural gas?
Not immediately.
Okay.
No.
Are you a little further out?
I burn wood and I burn a little fuel oil. As long as my back holds up, I'm going to burn wood. So.
questions? Any other questions from members? Thank you so much for sharing the story of your town.
I appreciate it.
All right, our last segment is to talk about energy assistance. We have two testifiers, Richard Fuchs, if I'm saying that right, and Karen Bowe. Thanks for joining us here at this unusual location.
Sure, this is exciting. And as chair, member, hi. I'm
Karen Moe. I work at Minnesota Community Action Partnership, the State Association of Community Action Agencies. Community Action Agencies, known locally as CAPS, are the primary service delivery vehicle for energy assistance program. First, I'd just like to say thank you so much to the Legislature and Department of Commerce for acting so swiftly this past legislative session and additional supplemental funding. You know it was really helpful to those households that needed it the most. You just heard a mayor from a small town talk about the average income that folks in his community make and the impact of the propane crisis had on those households to heat them. You know that $20 million was really helpful in those, for those households. Just a quick few things before I introduce my member, Richard Fox, who works for one of our agencies, Lakes and Pines, and they're the local service providers for the program. I'll let him speak more to the specifics about what community action agencies are doing, but some general things. First of all, to manage the cost of transportation, mortgage, food, medicine, along with heating your home, you know, for many people is a difficult situation. In the best of times for low-income families, that can be quite a difficult situation, but at the worst of times, and particularly this past heating season, with the increased cost of propane, that really created a crisis for those individual households and having to choose how they're going to meet their energy systems costs, their energy costs. Community action agencies work directly with the households, as well as the utility vendors, to help those folks make sure that they have heat in their home. Our agencies are the front line responding to the households and working with those folks to solve the situation. In anticipation of the upcoming heating season, Annie asked us for a couple of things that we were doing, and what I can tell you is Department of Commerce mentioned that they're sending out a letter to propane households. Our folks have been sending out letters to propane households as well, already encouraging them to anticipate another challenging heating season, try to get their tanks filled now while the prices are low. In particular, we've been trying to encourage folks to set up payment plans with vendors. We know this past heating season, having a payment plan either already in place or communicating with their vendors locally seemed to really help facilitate those vendors finding solutions to meeting those household needs. So we've really been trying to encourage households to work locally with their vendors. And we, as you've heard, I'm sure, over and over, many of those local vendors really did work with our agencies and with those households to make sure that homes received some fuel when they really needed it. You guys have mentioned already that pre-buy is a great option for many low-income households. Having that money up front simply is not available to them. So we've been encouraging households to get onto payment plans as much as possible. Lastly, the one thing I really want to say, and Deputy Commissioner Grant also referenced this, was investing in energy efficiency in homes. That's a permanent long-term solution. Senator Dibble, you asked about the need that's out there, and all of our agencies have waiting lists that we simply have never been able to get to, even with the Stimulus Act. In response to your question, it is on a first-come, first-served basis. There is a priority list that each agency comes up with that meets the federal rules for the Department of Energy Weatherization Assistance Program. Generally speaking, that entails households that have elderly children and families with disabilities. Those tend to be the top ones, but again, we service everybody in a first-come, first-served basis. Along with weatherizing homes, And we really think that that having homes that are energy efficient, not just in the short term but in the long term, really protects households from price volatility regardless of the heating source. Also creates a safer home for folks in the long term. You mentioned it, someone mentioned earlier, the PUC commissioner mentioned earlier, having propane, relying on propane as your heating source is not just a matter of filling your tank, it's also getting to the tank, oftentimes in the dead of winter when folks most need it. For households, for many households, that's a challenge. If it's a single woman that's living there, if it's an elderly person that's living there, that introduces a whole other set of issues. That can be challenging. We were really excited to see today that you folks were visiting the REAL facility. We happen to be, we love REAL. We have worked with them in the past. Many of our agencies have worked with the REAL folks to be trained as solar to site solar homes and to install them in conjunction with the DOE weatherization program. And I would say I think that's a great option, is to look at weatherizing homes and coupling it with renewable energy to really reduce the home heating costs for low-income folks as well as other folks. With that, I'll just say thank you and then turn it over to Richard Fox from Lakes and Pines.
Okay, well, I just want to thank you for inviting me to talk to you today. Our agency is based out of Mora, Minnesota, and we serve seven counties in the east central Minnesota area. One of the things we do is we serve a lot of people with propane. I've been told that our agency serves more propane customers than any other agency delivering LIHEAP in the state. So when this crisis happened, we were absolutely bombarded with calls for help trying to get fuel. It was a very challenging winter for us. I want to add my thanks to the state legislature for giving us the additional funds. We wouldn't have been able to make it through the rest of the year without those funds. As you know, low-income households have no reserves to access when unexpected events occur. This unexpected event caught all of them by surprise, and we had many, many calls for crisis. Energy assistance is based on a household's income, the number of people in the family, and the consumption of the heating fuel that they have in their household. So we collect that data. It all goes into a computer program, and it arrives at a grant that they are to get for their primary heat for the year. Now, if that doesn't get them through the winter, there's another program that's called a crisis program that helps keep the heat on in these houses when they have unexpected events like a disconnect from their connected utility or refusal to deliver by a propane company. So that's where a crisis program came in this last year. They raised the amount from $500 that we could spend to $1,000, which a lot of the times during the peak crisis when the prices were so high, we couldn't do a minimum fill with $1,000 for our customers. And so they had to come up with some money to pay the additional delivery. I will say that a lot of the vendors that we deal with were just as, bombarded with the calls as we were, and they really worked quite well with us to try and keep the heat on in people or people's houses, but it just was almost an impossible task to do. One other thing I want to talk about is I've heard the pre-buy program mentioned that maybe we could do something like that. Actually, the LIHEAP program did try that a few years ago. The results for the first few years were favorable because we got prices less than what the price went to in the winter, but then there was a couple of warm winters that came around and the price dropped, and it became a difficult thing to explain that to our customers why we were giving them pre-buy fuel at a higher cost than what they could buy it outright. But I think even that notwithstanding, that in the end I think that we save people money overall. But it also makes a lot of extra work for our agency to manage that, because you have every single vendor that you have that delivers propane, you have to get a pre-buy amount, and then you have to figure out who's going to get it and when that runs out. And it becomes a little more complex then, and we need more money to do that or more time. And given the funding from the federal level, it's been decreasing over the years. That also decreases the money we have to administrate these programs, and so it would be a challenge to do it, but because we think it would do our customers good, we'd be willing to try it again. So I asked my staff to just give me some information about what they saw this past winter. It was like, war room is the best thing I can compare it to. We had piles of applications all over the place of people that had called in for crisis. Just to kind of give you an idea of what we were seeing at least 50 calls for crisis in any given day, and we would have as many as 200 calls for people that were getting close to being out of fuel, waiting to be processed, and we were doing them based on what percentage they had left in their tank. That became our way of triaging all of this. So we were doing the ones that we felt were in the greatest need first. And once we processed them, then we had four boxes and three staff that were working on that daily. Our regular staff didn't have a chance to process the regular applications of the other customers that were waiting to get their applications processed because we were doing everything we could on the crisis applications. We hired a temporary staff person because this is, you just can't hire somebody off the street to come in and help us, so we were working overtime, pulling everybody that we could from different jobs in the department to help with this. I got a real hands-on appreciation for this, which I normally don't get. Mostly I just deal with the unusual situations and the problems, but I was there in the trenches plugging away at applications. And some of the effects that we saw on people were, the person from Federated had, Tim had said something about how that they had lowered their minimum delivery down to 100 gallons, and in the dead of winter, you could process a minimum fill for a client under crisis, and as soon as that delivery got out there, about a week later, they were calling in because they met the criteria to be eligible for further crisis if there was any available. You know, for instance, when you were at about $3-4 a gallon, 100 gallons, $300-400, and then maybe delivery charges, so it'd be about $500, so we could maybe do another one. But that's not the most economical way to run a program, is to give them 100 gallons, because most of the propane people I talk to call themselves a delivery program rather than selling a propane. They're not selling propane as much as they're delivering it. So every time they have to go out there again, that's additional cost to their, on their trucks, gas, whatever, propane, whatever they power their vehicles with. It's an additional cost, time, and all of the other things that go along with that. So that's just one of the things that we saw. There were some houses that weren't calling us back and letting us know what their situation was. They started out at 20%, and we tried to figure out when they were going to be necessary to serve them. And there were some that did run out of propane because we didn't know that they were that short. And that, of course, leads to the leaked tests and all the other costs that go along with that. Fortunately, those costs are eligible costs for fuel assistance, but still that's money that doesn't get to go to propane. Some of our vendors were quoting us a cost when we were calling for crisis, and when they'd get out there, they'd waive the extra delivery charges for a same-day delivery and put the money towards propane, which was a real nice thing. I have to say that our LP vendors that we dealt with, by and large, really stepped up to the plate this past winter. I was impressed with some of the things, like dropping the delivery charge to put in more propane. They were trying to do best, what's best for their customers. Based on our regulations, there were some problems that developed because of their enthusiasm. They would deliver fuel because they knew somebody had called for crisis, but until we authorized that crisis, we couldn't pay it because they had fuel. It's just a way the program was set up. It wasn't designed to deal with this type of an emergency, and we still had to follow all the other regulations besides. You know, they could mess with some of the higher level things, like increasing the amount we could spend for crisis and changing the guidelines so that we could serve additional clients up to 60% of state median income and a few things like that. But to the nuts and bolts of how the system worked, they couldn't make a change with that. So there was some bad fallout with that, but we did the best we could working with our vendors to make sure that we could help these clients. So much more I could talk about, but I think I'll just wait for questions and see if there's anything I can do.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions from members? Senator Dibble.
I had a question that occurred to me earlier. We had someone from the industry up. They said that there's a mandated leak check of a tank every time fuel is delivered. Yes. Two questions. One is, I think the implication was perhaps in these sorts of circumstances, maybe that shouldn't be required. I'm wondering if that's a good idea or a bad idea. It sounds like a bad idea. It sounds like a good idea to check for leaks. If a leak is found, what does that trigger? Does that trigger a cost to the customer, or is that a cost that's picked up by the supplier because the tanks are leased?
It adds a cost to the customer.
Uh-huh.
And the energy assistance program, that is an allowable cost that we can pay for if we have funding. So when I say if we have funding, because once we've expended all the funds we have available for a household, we're pretty much, that's all we can do. So I'm not exactly sure what the reasoning is behind it. I'm going to just make a wild guess at it, and you can ask one of the propane people whether I was accurate or not. But I think it's either a liability issue, that if somebody's got a leak in their system and you fill a tank up and you don't do a leak test, that because it had gone down so low that you could be filling their house up with propane and then a little spark and then it would blow up and they might find themselves liable for that. So I don't know what can be done about that. I don't think that they would want to take on that kind of liability.
How much does it cost to fix a leak?
Well, most of the time they don't find leaks, but I couldn't tell you for sure what the cost is to fix that leak. I haven't seen any bills lately. So.
I'd be curious if anyone is in May.
It depends on what the extent of the leak is. Sometimes you can fix a leak by tightening a nut on one of the fittings.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes it's something in the furnace that some debris has been blown through and then it's plugged an orifice open or something like that, which would allow the house to fill up with either natural gas or propane, depending on whatever it was. So.
Senator Russell.
Just a point of clarification, is the leak test required every time they fill, or is it
when the tank is empty?
Okay, so it's not necessarily every time, but it's when it empties they have to do it. So if you get it, if you fill the tank before it's empty, you don't have this issue.
I have a question for you. Do you know whether your compatriots in other states have any state funding for energy assistance or weatherization? I don't know if you go to national conferences and talk about things like this, but my understanding is here in Minnesota we only have the funding that flows through from the federal government. We don't have any state funding on top of that.
There have been a few instances where the state has given some extra funding for us to use for the energy assistance program. This past year is one example. I know for sure there was another year, but I couldn't tell you which year. But other states do have mechanisms to fund a low-income energy assistance program, which is supplemental to the federal monies. I don't know whether the gas companies around here want me to bring this up or not, but there's something called a universal service fund that's used in other states where there's a surcharge on every meter, every customer account or whatever, which goes into the universal service fund. And then they use that money to help people in need.
Actually, Representative Garofalo brought it up at one of our hearings during the session that in Wisconsin, you know, we had gone up to 60% of poverty or something, or I can't remember what the scale was that we changed,
yes,
but in Wisconsin they went up to 80%, and he was talking about how much more generous Governor Walker was than Governor Dayton, but that led us to discover that there may be a pot of money available in Wisconsin that's not available in Minnesota.
Correct. In the state of Minnesota, for both the low-income heating assistance program and the weatherization program, it's funded primarily, if not all, through federal programs. So it's the DOE that funds weatherization, and it's the Department of Health and Human Service that funds energy assistance. In Minnesota, as in some other states, the federal funding actually makes up a much smaller portion of the funding for those programs. So it varies state by state. And it varies by the programs, so some are utility-funded, some are funded through the legislature. I don't have the specifics in front of me, but I can happily get that to you in terms of a report of where, for both programs, for both weatherization and energy assistance, how the states fund them differently. In Minnesota, it's true we fund just through the federal program. In other states, they have a variety of programs, including Wisconsin.
Well,
Senator Gribble.
We do, at least the investor owns. Ratepayers do share some costs for folks who, seniors and others, to bring their rates down, and also to help in particularly dire circumstances. So there is a little bit of precedent in Minnesota. I know the Ratepayer Bill to be rejiggered, how we divvied up some of that money and what our threshold. Yeah.
You know, it just seems to me for a cold weather state that we ought to look to places like Vermont and Michigan and Iowa and the Dakotas and find out whether, you know, it's more typical in a very cold weather state to have a fund. I'm particularly interested in finding out on the weatherization front, because if we weatherize somebody's house and we bring their costs down 20% a month, that's that much less in energy assistance that we have to pay. So,
yes, right. That's true.
And we do have the Conservation Improvement Program in Minnesota, which is a utility-funded program, and there is a set-aside for low-income households. It's a small percent overall, and it's perhaps less than actually what
it doesn't cover the cost of doing a comprehensive weatherization on a particular house, but it, anything that comes in and helps is beneficial, so we appreciate whatever we can get. And you are correct that 60% of state median income, I believe that's a cap that we have here in Minnesota with the LIHEAP funds.
Any other questions from members? Senator Diebold.
I just wanted to continue on this theme of the weatherization issue. So it's a, I'm really interested in exploring how we might gain more ground on that subject more swiftly. It feels like we're just kind of treading water. Mm-hmm. You know, we have aging housing stock that only wears out in this really, really harsh climate, really hot in summer, really cold in the winter, so it feels like we're just kind of treading water. And I knew that when we had the ARRA funds, and that scaled up so fast, that we had a whole separate challenge of getting the workforce prepared and deployed. And then, of course, then there was a cliff on the other side, and that money went away. So it's a complicated problem, but it would be interesting to really tap some ideas about how to start gaining ground instead of treading water on that subject.
I would also just echoing back, Senator, to Representative Portman's question about state funding. I think you point out one of the challenges with the weatherization program was with the stimulus, there was a great, you know, influx of money. You train folks, and then there was this cliff. So the program had to expand and detract or contract very quickly.
Right.
I think, though, what happened as a result of it is that we do have a workforce that has been invested in and trained. That was the opportunity we also used with the Rural Renewable Energy Alliance, was we used some of those funds to actually train folks in siting homes and installing those panels. Now, the funding for those panels is no longer there, so while we have a trained workforce that can site and install the panels, we simply don't have the funds to install the panels. So I think, getting back to Representative Portman's question, having some level of state funding might actually stabilize the program, which would have a bit more of a longer-term impact on actually making a dent in that problem. When the agencies are too busy trying to figure out how to expand and train and then contract quickly, you know, knowing how to manage the program long-term becomes quite difficult.
Representative Poppy.
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. I just had a question. You had indicated that 50 crisis calls per day. I was just wondering, what is, in a more typical winter, how many crisis calls would you see in the season? And in addition to that, how much more of a caseload, or how many numbers of households of an increase did you see this past year?
Well, actually, I had somebody put together some numbers, and I actually have that with me today, which, boy, that worked out well. The previous winter, we had served 2,296 households in crisis. Last year, we served 4,123. So not quite double. So, now, did that completely answer your question?
I believe it did. So there, I mean, certainly a definite increase, and these are always, the people in crisis are the people that may or may not have contact with you other than that?
Well, they have to be eligible for energy assistance in order to qualify for the crisis thing. So they have been in contact with us and received what we call the primary heat grant, which is what every household gets. But then if they're under a threat of disconnect, or already disconnected, or if they're out of fuel, or the fuel company tells them you know, payment on delivery, then they can be eligible for additional funding through crisis.
Any other questions from our Senator Sumner?
Thank you. And just to follow up, so that, does that to say then that I don't think the qualifications change. So on a given year, people that may qualify may not ask for assistance.
That's
true. Last year, about twice as many did.
Well, of the households, those are crisis things that we did. So in a normal year, I believe the previous year we did just over 7,000 households total in our seven counties. Last year it was over 8,000, and that was one number I didn't get, so I can't give you the exact numbers. So the increase that we saw was only around 1,000.
Okay.
But that's still a significant increase. I think that was like 14%.
But almost twice as many crisis.
Exactly, households were in crisis.
He's referring to the crisis.
Yes.
Crisis numbers. But one clarification: energy assistance is an income qualification program, and Department of Commerce, and we applauded and appreciated Department of Commerce's decision to raise the income level this past year from 50% of state medium income to 60% of state medium income. And that really, my understanding is that really was done in response to the number of propane households that were contacting the Department of Commerce and simply had no resources. They were above that 50% line, but they had no other resources to turn to. So Department of Commerce acted swiftly, changed that. Our agencies addressed that. Now that rule has changed, and that might be something that Department of Commerce chooses to look at again if there is another crisis situation with propane or another heating source. But right now it's back down to the 50% of state median income.
Any other questions for members?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That completes the testimony. I think that we all owe 11 to 12 a huge thank you for managing this trip up here. And our next hearing will be on August 14th, and we will be looking at the issue of the utility business model and how that might change. Any other closing
questions?
And with that, we're adjourned, and we'll get on the bus. Thank you.